Are you hopeful that solutions can be found to quell the violence in Milwaukee in the long term? That's today's big question. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, August 17th. We will talk with the director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention about what led to the violence in Milwaukee over the weekend and how it can be addressed. And we will welcome your thoughts and your questions about what you think needs to be done. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Very happy to have with us Reggie Moore, the director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we did see you interviewed for a piece in the New York Times that was headlined, "Racial Violence in Milwaukee Was Decades in the Making," residents say. You are a resident of the Sherman Park neighborhood?
Yes.
Yeah. So do you agree with that headline? Was it decades in the making?
I think when you look at the conditions in Milwaukee and the data that supports it in terms of unemployment and the disproportionate or the disparities in the incarceration rate of African-American males, as well as the childhood poverty rate in Wisconsin, I think that when you look at even also cases that have involved police-involved shootings, I think that that's an accurate headline.
Yeah. So what was your personal reaction to the violence that took place in the neighborhood over the weekend?
Well, I'll start with the incident happened around 3:30 p.m. I arrived at the scene at approximately about 6:30, 7, and upon arriving on the scene, it was very clear that things had progressed to a point that it would have been really hard to pull back. I think that the community that had basically been at the scene when the shooting happened, and then the folks who showed up over those period of hours. Obviously the family member wanted answers and wanted information, but then other folks who knew this young man also, wanted to communicate or have some sort of insight from law enforcement on the scene. I think the challenge with the scene and talking with the officials who were there as well as the community is that the fact that the state had already taken control of the scene. And so MPD was pretty much, holding the perimeter. And so in terms of MPD had no control over the length of time that the state investigation was taking. At the same time, there was also not a lot of information from the state being provided to the folks at the scene. And so, that sort of set up the dominoes that sort of led to the frustration and the tension that rose.
Yeah.
Or at least that sparked that night.
So the only news that was out there immediately anyway was that a police officer has fatally shot an African American man who had been pulled over in a traffic stop. Yeah. And since then, of course, we have learned a little bit more. The police say that the man was armed, he had been fleeing, he turned around, and according to the police officer who shot him, had pointed the gun at him. So do you think it would have made any difference if those details were known right away?
It's always hard to look back. I think in looking at recommendations that are coming out nationally, both from Black Lives Matter and even professional law enforcement agencies, the more details that can be provided that don't, that won't harm the investigation of the case, the better. And I think that that's what the community, was demanding, at that time. And that's what, I think when you look at other incidents around the country, where at least these cases have been, handled immediately in terms of sharing as much information with the public. I'm not sure in terms of whether the race of the officer or, that the young man was in possession of a firearm or not. All of those details would be helpful to know. But at the same time, I think the thing that actually sparked, and when I say that, I mean in the media, but in terms of that actual scene, I think there may need to be more intention put into what kind of communication protocols happen at the scene of investigations. And that may be a state question, that may be an NPD question, but just really trying to figure out, what does that look like? And, I believe that the chaplains were on the scene as well, but I think that they were more so working with the families. But when we talk about the crowd and the public that shows up at these scenes, what is the communication protocol there?
Yeah. Why do you suppose some in the crowd took their frustrations out on nearby businesses and started a gas station on fire and some other businesses?
One thing that's apparent is that the destruction of the businesses were not, they weren't random or just tearing up the entire neighborhood, right? So I can understand how people may have a view that the entire neighborhood was up in flames and, that the city was burning. You hear a lot of that rhetoric. But there were a lot of businesses around the gas station, around the BMO bank, around the O'Reilly auto parts that were not damaged, vandalized, or burned. And so I think there's a question of, what in terms of the crowd, what was the motivation for targeting these particular businesses? And so I think particularly with the gas station, as you may be aware, there have been, issues in the recent past, and I think even over time, where in terms of young people in the gas station, right? So issues of vandalism, issues of some community members not feeling respected, being treated with respect in the store. And so we had actually recently been involved in a mediation involving the protesters and the store owners. And there were efforts to try to, and they had started to contribute to supporting efforts in the park. There were a number of, community organizations and individuals who were trying to work with young people in the park and were relying on, donations and things like that. And so the gas station has stepped up and, made a good faith effort to try to, be more involved in the community and contribute to those things. I think the gas station became a symbol in terms of at least the members of that community perhaps not feeling heard or feeling respected. And so despite, I think, the corner that had been turned with that gas station, it became, a target just in terms of the expression of the rage and things of the folks in the area.
Yeah. Well, the the violence, the unrest appears to be calming down since Saturday night anyway, when I think on Sunday that Governor Walker activated the National Guard, a curfew was imposed. Is that the key to keeping the peace, at least in the short term?
I think that I would, by Sunday, I would say I think things had calmed down. I didn't anticipate that there was going to be a significant, turnout in terms of protesters and then also one thing that I've had to clarify over time, at least from my observation, is that this was not necessarily, as you see in some other communities, an organized sort of Black Lives Matter, protest. This was especially the first and even to some degree the second night. Outrage from the neighborhood, from young adults and folks who knew this young man. Like that's where I would say a large amount of the crowd were not folks from outside the community, were not people unfamiliar with the area. And so I think more groups started to converge on Saturday, but yet and still I think most of it was driven locally. That's an important context, I think, to understand about about what happened. And so, in context with the marches and protests around Dontre Hamilton, those things were ongoing for months and very organized. So I think that's an important distinction to understand. And so I would say by the and so I didn't expect it to go on that for weeks or days. And so I think it's important to contextualize the response of closing down the park. I'm not sure how much that may have contributed to things dying down or not. Personally, I don't think that was very helpful. But in terms of, and the city already has a curfew in place. And so with all that being said, yes, things have calmed down.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll get into what needs to happen now. What efforts are underway? What still needs to be done to prevent violence in the future in the Sherman Park neighborhood and beyond? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with Reggie Moore, the director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. And we are asking you in today's big question, are you hopeful that solutions can be found to quell the violence in Milwaukee? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are asking in today's big question, are you hopeful that solutions can be found to prevent violence in Milwaukee? We are talking with our guest about the factors that led to the violence in Milwaukee over the weekend, and we wonder what you think is needed to prevent future violence. What is needed to improve the lives of Milwaukee residents of the Sherman Park neighborhood and beyond? And are you hopeful that those solutions can be found? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with the director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention, Reggie Moore, about what happened over the weekend and what led to that. And we will talk with him about what efforts are underway to prevent this. And I'd also like to talk about what the future holds, especially for African Americans in Milwaukee. Milwaukee, a city that has been just recently declared the worst city in the nation for African Americans, the worst city in the country. So, and Wisconsin, of course, has been also declared among the worst, if not the worst, state for an African American to live in. Reggie Moore, please address that. Why is Milwaukee considered the worst city in the nation for African Americans?
As I mentioned earlier, I think when you look at poverty, unemployment, and incarceration, I think those are the factors that drive, you know, that declaration. I think that declaration is driven by a number of factors, including, you know, the pervasive segregation that has occurred in this city. And I think, you know, when people hear that, they think it's sort of, you know, an insurmountable issue. Like, well, how do you address, you know, or sort of turn a corner on racism or segregation? And again, to your earlier, you know, point in terms of the New York Times article, that was decades in the making, right? So it wasn't a light switch that necessarily happened. But when you look at the amount of sort of blue-collar jobs that have left the city, that, you know, a lot of African-Americans who, you know, moved to Milwaukee during what we call the Great Migration from the South and were able to, you know, purchase homes and really provide, you know, stability for their families. A lot of those jobs and throughout the Midwest have closed, and the severe impact that's had on families that have remained in Milwaukee has been significant. And so there hasn't been industries to replace the industries that we've lost. There hasn't been significant changes in policies and practices to effectively address it. I mean, as indicated by the results and the declaration of us as a city and a state being the worst in the country. And so I think there's more to be done. And I think that's going to take vision and, you know, a lot of bold action and not just, you know, short-term solutions, but really focusing, you know, having a 10-year vision and really being dogmatic about dedicating the resources and policies to help move that forward.
Other parts of Milwaukee's north side have been plagued with crime. Milwaukee police say there have been more than 80 murders, homicides so far this year, which is less than last year, but still a lot. A recent news story pointed out that there were nearly 200 carjackings in the first 5 months of this year, which would be a 120% increase over the same period last year. I mean, what's going on, especially recently, that's contributing to this violence?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've seen through our homicide review research is that one of the factors that's driving homicides this year is related to intimate partner violence. And so intimate partner violence is a segment of domestic violence. And domestic violence could cover roommates. It covers, you know, whether, you know, a stepfather and a brother get into a fight. And intimate partner violence is a very specific relationship between, you know, the parties involved. A lot of the homicides in Milwaukee in general have been non-fatal shootings this year have also, and also even last year, have been driven by arguments and fights. And so what you're seeing is, you know, layered with the what I would call the trauma of, you know, poverty and despair and hopelessness, that gets manifested in a number of ways. And so, you know, tensions are already high. There's a level of desperation. And so it's easy, you know, for folks to say, well, you know, just walk away, or there has to be ways of not resorting to violence in certain situations. But when you have folks living in very dire conditions, and living in desperation, oftentimes it does not take much for something that would be considered a simple petty argument to escalate into something significant, especially when an intimate partner, money, or something else is involved.
Yeah. What about all those carjackings? What's going on there?
And one of the things that we've seen is that, I mean, in comparison to the overall numbers last year, that has actually slowed in terms of carjacking specifically. But I think, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, as you know, and from a public health approach, is always looking at the root causes of it. It's really also looking at, you know, what is the culture that's sort of driving that, right? So in terms of, in some cases, the cars are being sold for money. And when I say culture, I don't mean ethnically. I mean in terms of youth culture, right? Mm-hmm. So is there something happening in the streets where that's driving sort of this, you know, this type of activity? And so one of the things that we have, you know, heard is that in some cases the cars are stolen and sold, and in some cases also used as sort of mobile drug houses as well. And so really getting at, you know, oftentimes there's a trend that's happening in the street that drives a particular crime. And so that's also been a factor. The other piece is, one, I mean, you have in terms of adolescents in general, one, there's a significant increase risk-taking factor that comes into play, regardless of where you live, regardless of, you know, ethnic or religious background. Adolescents we've all engaged in behavior as teens that we look back now and say, wow, how do we, you know, do that? And so considering that factor in terms of just maturity and unfortunate, you know, lack of guidance. And we've been, through our department, trying to connect with some of the young people who've been involved in those incidents, and one of the things that has been really not necessarily shocking but apparent is that they have not been connected to supports and opportunities in this community that could have helped them, maybe kept them from getting, you know, onto the wrong path. So most of them have not been involved in an after-school or youth development program or had a mentor in their life. And so if everybody, you know, if most of the folks in your social network or in your neighborhood are engaging in questionable behavior, you feel like everybody's doing it. And so it's a really, you know, we're really focused on how do we get these young people connected to supports and resources to get back on the right track.
Yeah. Brian on Facebook says the history of the black economy and life in Milwaukee is so much more complicated than the armchair critics understand. He's responding to some other comments on Facebook. I'd invite you to hold your judgment, stop the condemnation, and engage in an attempt to understand the underpinnings of these events. If Wisconsin wants to help solve the crisis in Milwaukee, the first step is to take off the blinders and stifle the rhetoric and hyperbole. Well, that's so you agree with that. What else, what's the second step?
I think the second step is getting involved, and that there's different ways that, you know, everybody can't write a check, right? Everybody may not be able to, you know, start and run a nonprofit organization. So it's really important for people to understand, you know, one, what does action look like, you know, for them? And not saying that writing a check is not important, but really understanding and being connected to people. And this also be clear. Sherman, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about 53206, and now we're talking about Sherman Park. If something happens today, we could be talking about another neighborhood in Milwaukee. I think we also have to stop sort of segmenting the pain in this community and really understand that it is a citywide issue, right? And so when we look at poverty in the city, when we look at unemployment in the city, it is something that, is happening. And unfortunately, we seem to only pay attention when there's, violence or unrest. And so even for this conversation, I think it's important that we look beyond just quelling the unrest and look at what is the vision for a safe and healthy community. You know, what does a strong and healthy family look like? And to the point in that Facebook comment, I mean, the issue is that segregation, for example, that is the outgrowth of that, in the sense that if you're not connected or you can't, call somebody who lives in that neighborhood and say, hey, are you okay? What can I do? We're so disconnected, and again, segregation drives that there are people outside or even, in the outskirts of Milwaukee who may not have relationships or have any idea or connection to people in that neighborhood, and that's a problem. And so I think that if we're going to really, come together as a community, understand how to get involved as a community, we have to be connected as a community.
Let's go to the phones. Vince in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Vince.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thought is, I think personally, from my perspective in my neighborhood, when I look at the mayor, the alderman, the church, the neighborhood schools, all have failed Milwaukee. There's nothing progressive. In the last 12 years of these individuals being in office, nothing has changed. It's gotten progressively worse.
So you blame the current or the politicians and community leaders who are in office?
Exactly. I mean, it's as important as neighborhood services. When you call to get something done, something cleaned up, nothing ever happens.
Yeah. Well, what is needed that they're not doing?
I think if you look at the city of Milwaukee, I mean, you look at the area, it's dirty, it's filthy. No one's cleaning it up. When you call them because there's overblown grass in the neighborhood, things of that nature, nothing happens. It's perpetual. It continues to happen, and no one steps up to the plate.
Yeah. Well, what's your response to that, Reggie Moore?
I mean, I can't, dispute in terms of someone's experience as far as what they're seeing in the neighborhood, but, I mean, in terms of the way that city services show up in a community are critical. I mean, from our vantage point, when we talk about violence prevention or public safety, looking at the public infrastructure is a big part of that. And so it's in addition to opportunity, whether that be economic, workforce, youth development opportunities, as well as changing, social and cultural norms in neighborhoods, you can't do any, that has to be supported also with the physical infrastructure. So if, the neighborhood is not, receiving the services that it needs, that contributes to public safety.
Let's go to Mark in Madison. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
Good, Mark. What are your thoughts?
I know that there was some effort from the Obama administration to set aside some extra money for community policing, but I still see in the big cities in Wisconsin, the bigger cities in Wisconsin, that the police still are driving around in cars and have their windows up, and there's no connection with them and the neighborhoods. And I think they should get more back into getting out of their cars and walking the neighborhoods and getting to know people and having people get to know them on a personal level. I think the public safety aspects would become, I think, a lot more smooth and not perfect, but at least each side would get to know each other, and there would be some increased trust between the two groups.
So is increased community policing one of the solutions or efforts, Reggie Moore?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, both practice and research around the country to support that true community-based, policing does have an impact on the community. I think the recent, ruling around the residency in the city of Milwaukee for city employees is very concerning, to that regard. It obviously helps to have, officers who live in the city that they're, policing. And Also, I think expanding how we define policing, I think, is also, you know, something that should be on the table. I think that, you know, I know that departments have efforts to really be proactive and try to, you know, not just be responsive to crimes, but actually, you know, build relationships with residents, community organizations, and all of that is necessary. But again, it truly helps when you have folks, you know, from the community that are actually, you know, involved in the policing of the neighborhood.
Yeah. Milwaukee's Office of Violence Prevention was created in 2008 as a part of the city's health department. Why is violence considered a public health issue?
I think, you know, for years there was sort of effort to just sort of treat, you know, or just address, you know, violence as sort of on an individual level, right? And so it's just like bad people doing bad things. And thankfully, you know, a lot of thought, you know, in terms of, you know, researchers and practitioners and communities around the country really started to push the fact that we really have to look at, and if we have to treat, you know, violence as a public health issue, one, because of the amount of injury and death that results from it, and two, that it's not just random, right? So there are areas that violence is concentrated in. There are conditions that increase the risk factors around violence, and then there are protective factors that actually can effectively decrease the likelihood of someone either perpetrating or becoming a victim of violence. And so the CDC has been a champion of this, and really looking at if we're going to really tackle this issue, we have to, you know, look at it in that way. And the same way that, you know, the contagious diseases were, you know, treated around polio and other things. And so particularly in Milwaukee, you know, our or issues that we focus on within our department are domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking, gun violence prevention, and also youth engagement.
Yeah. Well, youth engagement is a big part of your background. You were the founder of the Center for Youth Engagement. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett appointed you to lead this Office of Violence Prevention in April, saying that your background working with young people in the community was a huge asset. And you say that you want to create a city where young people are thriving and not merely surviving. Mm-hmm. So in 2 minutes, how do you do that?
So a couple of things one, I want to acknowledge wholeheartedly the amount of efforts. I mean, I think there's this perception that there's nothing happening or that there's not enough happening, right? And so I'm not here to debate that. What I will acknowledge is that there is a lot of amazing work and efforts being done by youth organizations and community-based organizations, you know, every day in this community, in neighborhoods throughout the city. However, I think one of the things that we can do is work smarter and in a more coordinated fashion. And so that's sort of what I've committed my life to over the past 3 years and hopefully will be able to support the community in doing, you know, through this role as well. And so one of the steps in doing that is engaging the community and really coming up with a comprehensive violence prevention plan that focuses on what does a healthy community, what does healthy families, what does healthy young people, you know, look like, and what are the activities that support that, what are the resources required to advance that, and then what are the policies needed to sustain it. And so that's really one of the main steps that we'll be engaging in. But again, not stopping action in order to engage in planning. So right now, we don't have a comprehensive strategy or strategies around violence prevention in the city. So that's our first charge. We're doing that while at the same time supporting existing activities in the city through youth organizations. One of the things that we're funding is something called Safe Zones. And so if you're familiar with the Cure Violence Interrupter model, there's a documentary called The Interrupters that sort of highlighted this approach, is where you actually engage, train, and hire people from the community to engage in interrupting the cycle of violence. And so as I mentioned earlier, you know, arguments and fights are one of the biggest driving factors of violence in our city. And if we can get ahead of that, we can actually have an impact, you know, on that issue. And so in Garden Homes at Franklin Heights and Milwaukee are two neighborhoods of which we are testing an expansion of that model. But are looking to expand it in other neighborhoods and throughout the city as well in the coming years.
We are talking with Reggie Moore, Director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention, about creating a healthier Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network. What would you like to see done by government or city leaders or residents in Milwaukee to reduce crime, to create more opportunities, to provide more engagement for youth? Are you optimistic that life will improve in Milwaukee? That's today's big question. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. As immediate tensions in Milwaukee subside after a weekend marred by shootings and rioting, our guest is examining the factors that led to this violence and how they can be addressed. He is Reggie Moore, the director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. And let's take some calls as our lines are full. Jeff in Appleton is with us. Hello, Jeff.
Hi there. I'm not real optimistic that anything's going to change. As long as the people in these communities keep looking to the state and the city and other people to improve their situation, it's really not going to change. It takes absolutely nothing from government or parents to make their keep their kids in school and to get them that high school diploma. A huge step. It takes absolutely nothing from government for fathers to stay with their families.
Well, let's get Reggie Moore. He's blaming this on, I guess, single families not keeping their kids in school, fathers who are absent, that sort of thing.
Right. I think there's always a personal responsibility angle, you know, to when we talk about any, you know, community issues, especially as they are systemic. At the same time, you cannot ignore the systemic factors that contribute to that. It's very, and let me be clear. I was raised by, you know, a single mom, and I have an older brother, and, you know, witnessing the struggles that she had in raising us, and, you know, she did an awesome job with what she had. But at the same time, she was no competition for the environment in which we were in. Now, she did an amazing job, obviously. But at the same time, in terms of when, you know, my social circle, the amount of drugs that was in my neighborhood, you know, that makes that job the best parent. It makes it a challenge, right? And the times that she went, you know, for extended periods of time, you know, unemployed, and she doesn't have a criminal record. It's not like she made, you know, personal decisions to end up in the conditions that we were. But at the same time, there were things happening in the environment that made her ability to actually raise two African-American boys extremely hard. And so when you multiply my family by thousands and hundreds of thousands in concentrated poverty, that is a problem that, yes, that public officials do have a responsibility and an accountability to address.
Let's go next to Rayon in Winona, Minnesota. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, go ahead.
Basically, I think there's three main things that both parties need to address. And by parties, I mean law enforcement and government, as well as the community. First off, education, I think, is a huge thing. Education of both parties, ensuring that everyone is aware of the consequences of their actions and that they will be held accountable for those actions. Through education, though, there would need to be, secondly, a level of trust from both parties. Trust for the police officers that they are making the correct decisions when they are presented with hard choices to make. And secondly, trust from the community for the police officers that, you know, a police officer pulling over an African-American individual isn't going to have to go into fight or flight response immediately. You know, that they can trust the people that they're dealing with so that they don't have to feel like they're making those hard decisions all the time. And thirdly, with all that comes respect. There's never going to be any progress made if neither party is having respect for one another, and also respect for themselves. The community, like, they can't be, you know, doing damage to their own community. They need to respect themselves and respect that they need to take steps in order to get themselves out of the tough living situations that they're in. And same with the police officers, respect for the communities that they're watching. And it kind of goes back to, I believe, what Mark said earlier, that, you know, police officers need to get out of the cars and show respect to the communities that they are, you know, supposed to be taken care of.
Yeah. So do you agree that mutual respect is an important factor, Reggie Moore?
Yeah, and I think that's something that the mayor has definitely been very vocal about, that, you know, the work is a two-way street, right? I think, you know, I think a lot, sometimes we hear that, well, the community needs to, you know, respect and treat law enforcement, you know, and trust law enforcement. But the mayor has said, it, you know, it's both ways, that he also expects, you know, officers to show up and engage with the community from a place of dignity and respect. And so it's really important that that is understood, but then there's also true efforts within, you know, systems like law enforcement and other systems that engage with the community, that they're very cognizant and of their policies and practices and making sure that they're not, you know, increasing harm in communities. And so I think that that's the way that you build trust is by you, how you actually perform, you know, and engage with the community in which you're working.
Does the government, whether it be the city, the county, or the state, somehow need to be tougher on crime to deter criminal behavior?
I think it needs to be smarter on solutions. I think that it's very clear that mass incarceration hasn't worked, right? And we have thousands of people returning to Milwaukee, you know, almost, you know, pretty much monthly in this community. And so if they're returning to a community that does not have jobs, that does not have economic development, that does not, you know, or at least that strains, you know, access to educational opportunities, all of those things are factors that we're almost setting people up to fail. And so if we don't really get a handle on reentry in terms of folks that have, you know, committed or made mistakes and ended up, you know, incarcerated, whether it be for 2 years or whether it be for 10 years, they have to return to the community at some point. And so when we look at the fact that when, you know, when I hear from the chief and others that a lot of the folks that they're arresting are repeat offenders, if we're going to get a handle on crime or violence in our community, we have to deal with, you know, that issue. You know, obviously addressing on the front end the mass incarceration piece, but then on the back end really looking at what does reentry look like and how do and what is the economic and educational and other opportunities that are going to be needed to really support this population when they return, because if they don't, the crime will definitely continue at the rates that we're seeing.
Let's go to Nikki in East Troy. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, thank you for having me. Just commenting that you had a previous caller that, you know, felt that, you know, he wasn't optimistic that Milwaukee would be better. And unfortunately, I feel the same way. Being a 24-year-old African-American female, I moved out of Milwaukee for a reason because of that problem. Unfortunately, it not only falls on the government, but it also does fall on the parents and the families of these kids and the youth that are causing these problems. You know, with the government not putting enough money into these programs and not having any motivation for these kids to want to be in school or to stay in school or any after-school activities, that also has a problem. They don't have the motivation. They have nowhere to go. But when you think about the home situation, if their parents are not focused on their children, they're focused on this man or that woman or this kind of drug or whatever, then they also have no motivation. They're not seeing their parents do anything right. I was raised by a single mom, and I'm the oldest of five. She worked her butt off for us, and that was my motivation to do better, to be a better person.
Nikki, thank you for the call. It was a little bit fuzzy because of our connection, but so she said she was a 24-year-old African-American woman, I believe, who moved out of the city because of all the problems she was seeing. But in part she was saying, and let me get your response to this, Reggie Moore, that government needs to help and invest in programs, invest in schools, invest in opportunities. Any disagreement there?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, we have to really contextualize. I think we do a really good job of compartmentalizing pain. And I think it's very important that we start to look at things in context, right? So I know that you can say, hey, you know, we just need to, kids need to go to school. And, you know, even the most motivated young people, and I've worked with young people all my life, and, you know, the most brilliant young people go to schools that are severely under-resourced. So when you have an attack on education in a state or in a city, and you want kids to go, and we assume that if there's a school building and American flag outside of it, and there's books inside of it, and adults, that education is happening there. And that's not always the case. And it makes it a lot harder when those schools and those buildings and those people in those buildings are under-resourced. And so the quality of education that folks are getting is a challenge, right? So that's one piece of it. The other piece is, again, you know, when we look at what people do to cope, right, and we look at, you know, the effect that heroin is having, you know, in our community, the effect that crack cocaine has had historically in the Black community, those things have an impact. So if the parent is not even coherent to know where their child is, or to, you know, they're not showing up at the parent-teacher conference. So we can't just look at, you know, how do we address crime, or how do we address, you know, education. Like, we have to understand that these things are interconnected, and someone struggling with a chemical dependency or untreated trauma will have an impact on that young person and their ability to make it to school in the morning, their ability to stay in school, their ability to focus in school. And so I think it's oftentimes easy to say there's one sort of magic solution, or if we just fix this, that'll fix everything. No, it's going to take a multi-layered, multifaceted approach. And unfortunately, I think we definitely need to work smarter in doing that.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. What is your hope for the city of Milwaukee?
I'm glad you asked. So I want to make sure that it's clear that I'm very hopeful about Milwaukee. And keep in mind, you know, I historically had a love-hate relationship with the city. I actually lived and worked in D.C. for a while and came back to Milwaukee. And when I think about, you know, and I've worked with, you know, communities around the country, there's something very special about this city. It has significant challenges, but I believe it has significant potential. And I think that, you know, people are rising up. People are in positions and places, and not only in government, but also in community, that can really bring about a change in this city. But again, the one thing I will agree with some of the callers is that, no, it can't be a complete reliance on government or a complete reliance on systems and institutions, because some of the most powerful work that's happening in this city is being driven by residents or individuals who are taking control of, and not when I say taking control, I don't mean from a law enforcement perspective, but taking ownership of their block and working with the young people and mentoring and creating community gardens. Those things are extremely powerful.
We will leave it there for now. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you.
Reggie Moore, Director of the Milwaukee Health Department's Office of Violence Prevention. You can vote in our online poll about the future of Milwaukee at WPR.org/joy. I'm Joy Cardine. Thanks to producers Bill Martins, Naeja Ellison, and Brianne Chasseau.